a validation of her work and her professional reputation. She was the reigning expert on Jovian class life throughout human space and was unlikely to be dethroned anytime soon. A passing pod of blimps brought a slight grin to her face. "You have that smile," I said. "Remembering our first encounter?" Bridget laughed.
"Or the city's first encounter?"
She turned from the window.
"Howard, political issues come and go, but politics will be with us forever. We'll just outwait them. Eventually people will calm down or forget, or we'll just wait until they're dead and a new generation is in charge. Meanwhile, we keep a relatively low profile. We'll be okay. We have forever, remember?"
"The kids.
The current batch are all adults. We'll have to hold off on new adoptions for a while.
You said you needed a break anyway.
Maybe it's time for another expedition. I have several candidate planets lined up, all with interesting-looking ecosystems."
"You've heard what Herschel and Neil are planning?"
"Yes, but they have to get to Romulus, load up, then get out of human space. It could be as much as 100 years before they reach the first new system, with no guarantees that it'll have anything worth exploring. And we can join up remotely, if and when. I want something a little more immediate."
I nodded. Bridget was right. If it came down to it, we'd only be in trouble if the humans tried to confiscate our assets. And we had lawyers up the yin-yang for just that eventuality. We could literally keep the fight going in the courts longer than most of our opponents' lifetimes. "All right, my love, you lead. Where do you want to go today?" 16. Still trying. Bob, July 2334, Nirvana River System. I found myself surreptitiously reaching for my face again and consciously brought my arm back down. I had disguised myself once more, this time using a random passerby as my model. To avoid a twins issue, I'd tweaked the appearance a little. If I ran into my model, he might think he'd discovered a long-lost brother, but nothing more. After much soul-searching, I'd reluctantly left Bender tied up in the tree. No Quinlan was going to climb that high, not even with a gun pointed to their head. Wildlife tended to be small and not overly curious if something didn't smell like food. Bender was probably okay, but I was still terrified that something might happen and I'd have no way of ever finding him. But I had to make a clean break from Bob running around with Bender on his back to random guy going on a trip, and the best way to do that was to never allow anyone to see anything that would link us. So, Enoki fun guy, social gadfly, and otter about town, was going to book a cruise on a local luxury vessel. Or, more factually, I was going to try to work my way across 7 segments disguised as random guy. But, and this was the good part, I would have luggage. I glanced up at the sign over my destination. Happy Al's Storage and Trunks. Well, that's not quite what it said, but metaphorically it wasn't far off. Quinlan's didn't go in for Samsonite luggage, but they did have occasional need for rigid boxes of the locking variety. Some of the items on display very much resembled old-fashioned steamer trunks, except without the metal strapping. That would have cost more than I was worth. But wood and leather could do a pretty good job, if worked properly. Happy Al, who, it turned out, went by the name of Steve, greeted me effusively as I walked in the door. I guess that business had been slow and Steve was bored to the point of suicide. That could work for me. "I'm looking for one of those," I pointed to a steamer trunk, "about this size." I held my hands apart to illustrate. "I wanted a trunk that would be bulky enough that someone couldn't grab it and run away, but small enough for me to carry. And with a security loop, like the one in the window." Steve straightened.
"Sir, all of our trunks have security loops and locks. We carry only the best stock."
On the one hand, that was good. On the other hand, it sounded expensive, but this part of my plan had very little wiggle room. Steve made for the back of the shop and returned in seconds with a trunk that was just about perfect. I gave it a brief once-over, including opening it to check the interior. This was as close to exactly right as I was going to get. How much?
8 irons, 4 coppers.
Ouch. I let surprise show on my face and didn't move for a 2 count. That's, Steve became chagrined, realizing he'd overreached.
That is, of course, retail. However, it's a slow day, so...
I took the hint. I have 7 irons, 6 coppers. I opened my hand to show him. That's all I have in the world, and I do need this item. Steve looked briefly relieved, then managed to suppress it. Apparently that was still above cost.
That will be acceptable.
I handed him the money and took the trunk. It was a good thing he hadn't dug in his heels. I might have spit up my remaining 2 irons just to see his expression. The trunk had a nice lock on it, made of whatever insanely hard wood they used instead of metal. It could probably be forced by a determined thief, but the point was to not attract the attention of thieves in the first place. To that end, as soon as I was back to my tree, I started rubbing dirt on it to take the shine off. A few minutes' attention got me a suitably grubby and time-worn trunk. Next, I harvested some dry grasses for cushioning and lined the inside. When the preparations were all done, I climbed the tree and retrieved Bender. I removed the matrix from my much-maligned backpack, then placed it carefully in the trunk, making sure the organics were packed densely enough to not shift. I spit out my 1 remaining spider and put it in the trunk with the matrix. The spider was my insurance policy. It would make some modifications to the trunk to make it harder to open or steal, and if worse came to worse, some thief was going to get a face full of plasma cutter. The backpack wasn't looking good. The cube had stretched it, and I couldn't be sure that it would spring back into normal shape. If not, I would stand out, even without the matrix. I sighed, shook the backpack a few times, then put it on. I'd stand out more without one at all. 1 last item to take care of. Hugh, you got a sec?
Sure, what's up?
I'm about to apply to be a deckhand. Anything I need to know? Is there a guild or union?
No, not like what you mean. There's a guild, but it's mostly just for arbitration and setting rates, and you're in it automatically if you work on a ship.
So there isn't a problem with treatment of laborers?
These are Quinlans, Bob. They can live off the land. If someone started beating the deckhands, they'd just all swim away. If they didn't outright disembowel the miscreant. Have you met Quinlans?
Fair point. So they're cantankerous, mobile, can find food anywhere, and can sleep anywhere.
Uh-huh. Kind of hard to develop an oppressed underclass in those circumstances.
What's the pay?
1/2 iron per day. If someone tries to offer you below that, snarl and walk away.
Gotcha. Thanks. That was better than expected. Hugh had gotten a job right away, so I hadn't really expected a problem. But any Bob would tell you that Murphy was a bitch. I arrived at the riverfront, trunk slung over my shoulder, and headed for the docks. There were several boats tied up, but only one had any activity. Some pallets were being unloaded, and there was also some cargo waiting to be brought on board. It looked like my best bet, if only because the other 2 boats appeared to be deserted. Still, I examined the 2 deserted vessels, frowning. They weren't empty. There were some palleted boxes and bales, but it was odd that no one was about. However, Quinlan deckhands were swarming over the 3rd boat, practically sprinting from job to job. I noted in passing that they weren't wearing the almost ubiquitous Quinlan backpacks, although 1 Quinlan who was standing around screaming orders and invective in almost equal amounts was wearing what appeared to be a vest with pockets. The Quinlan with the vest paused and spoke to me, guessing what was on my mind.
Part of the shipment's late. We got lucky. We were here first and signed for what was waiting. You looking for work?
I am. You hiring? She gestured at the boxes on the dock.
That fag isn't going to load itself, although the lazy sots I already pay for no reason seem to be hoping it will.
The Quinlan's unloading the boat replied with pro forma insults and 1 Quinlan middle finger equivalent. It seemed good-natured, though. Say the word and I'll start hauling.
You got it. Get to work.
Well, that was easier than I had any right to expect. There was no need to ask where they were going. Boats almost always went downstream unless they were very local, and on this river segment, downstream was east, toward the Garrick's spine segment. Can I drop off my trunk? She gestured to a corner of the boat, attention already on the next problem. I dropped off the trunk, and after a moment's thought, took off my backpack as well. Being a deckhand on a Quinlan boat was very much a strong back, weak mind kind of thing. Pick up box here, put box down there. Rinse, repeat. My Manny was much stronger than a native, and I didn't get tired, but overheating could be an issue, so I didn't push it. Every once in a while, the entire crew would take a fiver in the water to cool off, which told me I wasn't the only one with that problem. The work was accomplished with the minimum of conversation. We'd keep working until all the cargo was moved, so malingering of any kind was pointless. Everyone just wanted to get it done. When the last box had been loaded, we parked our butts on the edge of the boat while the Quinlan in the vest, who turned out to be the captain, argued over the paperwork with the dockmaster.
"Welcome to the Hurricane," one of the deckhands said. "I'm Oryk. This is Ted, and this is Frida."
I was momentarily taken aback and looked closely at Frida. No, definitely not the same person. Same Quinlan name, though, which the translation software converted to the same English name.
"Enoki,"
I replied. "Enoki Fungi." Oryk looked mildly surprised.
Family name, and you're deckhanding."
"We are an old family," I told him, "but we were never wealthy. My mother always told me, we've earned that name and you'll damned well use it." "Yes, Mom." That got chuckles, but I wasn't sure if my momentary flippancy hadn't set me up for trouble. I'd forgotten that family names were little short of hereditary titles in Quinlan society. Had I just painted myself as a target? Well, I'd have to roll with it.
"We also have a paying passenger," Ted volunteered. "He's off shopping. Captain Lisa told him to be back before midday or he would have to find another ride. He's cutting it pretty close."
"He also has a last name," Frida added, "as he reminds us constantly. I've come close to opening his throat a couple of times, but the captain says we have to be polite to the paying passengers."
She made a face to indicate her opinion of the command. Captain Lisa finished haranguing the dockmaster and the two exchanged signatures. She marched up the ramp and glared around.
"His Highness not here? Oh well. He paid in advance. Let's haul ass, people. We need to hit Melon Patch by nightfall."
We jumped up and started releasing lines and pulling up boarding ramps. There wasn't much to it, but I made a point of taking orders from the others without complaint or trying to improvise. Just as we were at the point of pushing away from the dock and raising sail, a fat Quinlan came puffing, yelling, and waving one arm. The other arm was holding onto a trunk, not unlike mine, except much newer looking. Quinlans were fat by nature, resembling beavers more than otters in that respect, but this individual was fat even by Quinlan standards, and out of shape to judge from the panting and gasping. The captain growled under her breath but motioned us to lower one gangplank. The Quinlan put his trunk down and trudged up the ramp, still trying to catch his breath. As he passed the captain, I heard him say,
"Have someone retrieve the trunk, please."
The captain gave him a sour look but motioned to me. I had a strong urge to accidentally drop it into the water, but I was in a uniquely bad position to get into a game of tit for tat, so I played it straight, bringing the trunk on board and depositing it with the other miscellaneous items, including my trunk. But I gave the translation software specific instructions for converting his name. "So, who is he?" I asked Ted.
"Snidely Whiplash. His family is big in the wine business, as near as I can tell. He's just an entitled whelp, though."
The beverage wasn't exactly wine, but it was the result of fermenting some local fruit. And as with most alcohol, it was big business. I was no stranger to snot-nosed kids who thought their parents' success made them a big deal. This voyage might end up being more difficult than anticipated. With our passenger safely, if obnoxiously, aboard, we cast off. Ted and Frida pulled up the sail, and we wallowed majestically out of port. The Hurricane was basically a barge with a sail, and it had all the racing feel appropriate to the design. I began to wonder if we'd make it to the end of the segment. Speaking of which, hey, Auric, does the Hurricane jump segments?
If we've got the cargo to justify it, otherwise we circle into the Arcadia River and head back to the other end. Lisa's not one of these big-time operations with a set route. If you were to get on the Galway, they never leave this segment, just up and down each river circling the world. It's not a terrible life. If you want to head into the next segment, you can get off at High Peak. There will usually be a boat going through within a day or two. The Hamilton jumps segments. I think they'll go 3 or 4 segments sometimes. Again, though, depends on cargo.
Have people around here ever named any of the segments? Auric shook his head.
It's bad luck. You name your segment, you start to identify with it, almost like a nation. Then you start to talk about borders and armies, and the next thing you know, you've been scattered as punishment.
Frida, having finished with the sails, had joined the group.
It's not punishment, it's...
Yes, I've heard your doctrine before, Frida. It's not for us to judge the administrator.
I'm not judging, Auric. I'm discussing their motivation, and it does make a difference. Punishments escalate. Guidance doesn't.
We were interrupted by a snort from midships.
You yokels and your legends about gods and demons, it is to laugh.
Frida glared at Snidely, which didn't dent the supercilious expression on his face in the slightest.
Legends? Are you defective? The administrator is as much a fact of life as the weather, or do you think rain is a myth too?
Sure he is. He makes the grass grow, lifts the little birds into the air, and makes the sun rise in the morning.
I stared in disbelief. This buffoon apparently believed that Heaven's River was a natural environment. I opened my mouth to correct him, then was overcome by the sheer irony of the situation. I was about to explain to an atheist that God was real. I wanted to facepalm, but that would create questions. Best let the regulars take it. Auric and Frida formed an unsteady alliance, arguing against Snidely's amused intransigence. He was a classic case of Dunning-Kruger, so entrenched and confident in his ignorance that he didn't even realize how much he didn't know. I let the argument drone on in the background while I watched the shoreline drift by. As enjoyable as the days on the river with my friends had been, there was a lot to be said for the sailor lifestyle as well. The argument had escalated to the point where it attracted the captain's attention, though.
Enough! She yelled. "His deck's to be cleaned. The bilge needs pumping. The cargo still hasn't been tarped. And the spinnaker still hasn't been raised. Make yourselves useful."
Well, that was that. And Snidely took this turn of events as a victory, to judge from the pleased expression on his face. The next couple of days were uneventful. We got caught in a brief downpour, which elicited howls of complaint from Snidely. Why a creature that was designed for water should hate rain was beyond me, but then again, the family dog used to be on a first-name basis with every puddle and stream in our neighborhood, but would feign death when we tried to bathe her. Go figure. I continued to avoid interaction with Snidely. The other three seemed to be able to keep his attention. Auric and Frida had called a truce over their minor doctrinal differences in order to form common cause against the infidel. I was going to have to discuss this with Bridget. It seemed the administrator was taking on the aspects of a formal belief system, complete with competing dogma. Against that was a version of atheism that didn't so much pit science against religion as simply refuse to go along. I wondered what Snidely's cosmology would look like, but having to talk to him would be too high a price to pay to find out. We pulled into a town that Ted informed me was named Beetlejuice. No, I'm not kidding, nor did I tweak the translator. It turned out this town's major industry was a form of liquor made from the excretions of some insect. First,
What?
Second, it made me wonder, not for the first time, if there was some form of sense of humor involved, either from the Skippies or from the software itself. I decided to let the translation stand and assigned it to the beverage as well. Beetlejuice was the last town on the Nirvana before the Segment Mountains. The captain would decide in the next day or two if we'd be continuing downriver or catching the transfer tributary to go back the other way. A lot would depend on what cargo we could get and where it would be the most valuable. It depended on paying passengers, too. If people were willing to pay to get to a particular destination, that would affect the captain's decision. Which made me wonder where Snidely was going. If we weren't going in the right direction for him, this would be goodbye. I tried to summon a tear, and failed, miserably. As we got closer, I could see that there was considerable activity at the docks, and it didn't seem to be all from the usual dock business. Four or five cargo ships were tied up while their crews had what appeared to be loud, bellicose discussions with official-looking individuals wearing sashes and swords. I felt a sinking feeling in my stomach. It seemed unlikely that this had anything to do with me, but by this point, any indication of cops made me as jumpy as a two-bit thief. Captain Lisa hopped around on deck yelling orders at us, trying to maneuver the hurricane into a tight space along the dock. This also involved a shouting match with the dock hands, which just added to the general holiday atmosphere. But eventually we were at dock and tied up properly. Ted and I grabbed the gangplank and started maneuvering it onto the dock. Before it had even settled, a delegation of cops marched up the plank. Captain Lisa moved to intercept them.
"We are searching for a fugitive who may be taking transport downriver," the sergeant said. "We will need to inspect your ship."
"What? All our cargo? Are you kidding me? Do you have any idea how long it'll take?"
The sergeant shook his head.
No. We're concerned about one specific individual carrying what appears to be a funerary box in his backpack."
"Uh-oh. Chances that there were two such fugitives on a billion-mile-long megastructure? Pretty low." I tensed and started planning escape routes before I remembered that I no longer resembled Bob, and I was not wearing a backpack at the moment.
"We will also need to inspect personal luggage."
"Oh, shit."
"You will like hell,"
Snidely exclaimed, striding up and sticking out his chest.
"And who might you be?"
The cop glared at him and put a hand on his sword.
"I am Snidely Whiplash of the Whiplash family. You've no doubt enjoyed our wine on many occasions. We can bring considerable pressure to bear if our family name is insulted."
The cop was taken aback, no doubt dealing with powerful families, especially belligerent powerful families, was considerably above his pay grade. After a moment, the cop replied,
"Yes, sir. Understood. Obviously, you would not be a suspect in any case. Your luggage is where?"
Snidely casually waved a hand in the direction of the miscellaneous pile.
"See that it isn't touched."
As I followed Snidely's hand wave, I got an idea. As casually as I could, I moved in the direction of the pile where our trunks were located. I began to untie the tarp covering the trunks and other small items. As I gathered it, I surreptitiously wiped off my trunk as much as I could. It still ended up looking more travel-worn than Snidely's, but not by much. A couple of cops came over, evidently pleased with my cooperation, and started looking over the pile. "Those are Mr. Whiplash's trunks," I said, pointing to the two items. "Everything else is just cargo." One of the cops nodded to me, and they began randomly opening boxes.
"How many people aboard?"
one said to me. "Captain Lisa, Ted, Frida, Oryk, myself, and Mr. Whiplash were all on deck." I pointed to each individual as I named them.
"None matches the description,"
the other cop said.
"And this is just junk,"
he added, waving at the boxes. "I'm sure the captain would disagree," I replied with a small smile. The cop snorted and they moved back to the gangplank. One shook his head at the sergeant. A few seconds of discussion with Captain Lisa and the cops trooped away. Letting out a breath, I re-tarped the miscellaneous pile. As I straightened up after tying the last bite, I found Snidely gazing at me, a slight frown on his face. As casually as possible, I gave the tarp a tug and walked off to my next chore. But any attention from anyone was bound to be a bad thing. I would have to keep an eye on his bigness. As it turned out, we would be crossing segments. Two passengers signed on, wanting to go in that direction, and the captain was able to subcontract on a shipment to Orchard Hill, just on the other side of the mountains. Subcontracting wasn't as potentially profitable as hauling our own goods, but it was a no-risk payday, and a couple of paying passengers was just bonus. The passengers, a very old Quinlan and her granddaughter, were heading back to the family home. Teresa was far too old to endure any kind of extended swim, so Belinda had swum upstream several hundred miles to take her home. Quinlan's had a strong reverence for the elderly, so the captain didn't balk at all when we set up a comfortable area in the sun for Teresa. Even Snidely didn't seem inclined to complain. Belinda doted on her grandmother, but wasn't otherwise talkative. She was friendly, but she would never use two words when a gesture or a grunt would do. On the few occasions that she did have to speak full sentences, she seemed to be almost out of practice. Remembering Bridget's comments about breeding away from tool user intelligence, I wondered if this might be a sign of that. Or maybe she just wasn't a talker. Once they were settled in, we went through the by-now routine frenetic running around that characterized leaving port. The cargo we'd taken on at Beetlejuice, which was mostly Beetlejuice, no surprise, was making the hurricane wallow a little more than usual, so we were taking extra care to maintain a good conservative trim. Once the boat was in mid-river and running in easy reach, we were able to break for lunch. I jumped in with the other crew members and we chased down some juicy fish. Yum. Unfortunately, given the close quarters, I had to be seen to be eating, sleeping, and so on, just like everyone else. So, fish for breakfast, fish for lunch. When I was done with the Bender rescue, I resolved that I would never go near fish again. We brought up a dozen or so as well for the captain and passengers. I sat down with Teresa and Belinda, studiously ignoring Snidely, who was snarfing back fish like he hadn't been fed in weeks. The Pav would have approved of his table manners. My mother, not so much. Belinda quietly removed the less desirable fish parts with a small but doubtless expensive knife and offered the fillets to her grandmother, who took them with a smile.
"Belinda's not much for talking," Teresa said to me. "I've watched you try to engage her in conversation."
She placed a fond hand on her descendant's head.
"Kids are getting less and less verbal, it seems."
I have a friend who commented that it's less necessary in Heaven's River, so intelligence is being gradually bred out.
"With some help from the administrator? I've heard that theory. Not impossible, but their manipulation would have to be very subtle."
"Oh, in Father's name, more yokel superstition," said Snidely. "Save me from the uneducated."
Teresa gave him a mild stare.
"And what's your educational background, Mr. Whiplash?"
"I have a master's in business from the University of Peachland," he replied haughtily.
I checked the translator out of curiosity. That wasn't bad. Close enough to retain the meaning anyway, although I doubted that a master's had quite the same meaning as a human university degree.
"And you took classes at Peachland?"
Teresa asked.
"Of course."
"I taught courses at Peachland, Mr. Whiplash. Don't talk down to me. I have several doctorates in subjects much more relevant than how to count money for those who've had their life handed to them."
"Whoa." Snidely jerked back, and I imagined flames sparking at the end of his whiskers. As much as I disliked him, obvious glee wouldn't be helpful, so I maintained a stone face as he stood stiffly.
"That would have been very handy, I suppose.
before senility set in, he said, showing his canines.
Belinda turned on him, snarled, and extended her claws. Snidely jumped back, surprised and alarmed by her reaction.
You're a small man with a small, shriveled soul, Mr. Whiplash,
Teresa said.
There is no bigger waste than a formal education given to someone incapable of using it. I have no doubt your whole life would disappear into your father's accomplishments without leaving a ripple.
Snidely glared at her for a moment, totally silenced, before stalking off. That went well, I said. Teresa chuckled.
And what about you, Mr. Fungi? You have a last name as well. Do you have anything to show for it?
Not really. My family earned the name long ago. Nowadays, it's mostly useful for keeping people like Snidely from patronizing me too much.
Do you believe, as Mr. Whiplash apparently does, that the world came about naturally?
Of course not, I replied. It's a rotating structure, 100 hen in radius, composed of segments each 1,000 hen in length. The ratio is clearly artificial. The experiment to determine the rotational period is something we did in our first year classes. It's exactly what you'd need in order to generate 0.86G. I was taking a chance showing any scientific chops, but I wanted Teresa to approve of me. Not just because she appeared to have a ferocious intellect, but also because I might learn something useful. This could turn out to be the first truly useful encounter since we'd landed. She nodded slowly.
Ah, an engineer. A frustrating occupation, I imagine. So much of what you know you could do is forbidden.
And what did you teach, Teresa?
Philosophy, math, history.
She smiled sadly.
That last item is particularly frustrating. Even in my lifetime, I've watched people letting go of some of the more difficult aspects of Quinlan history in favor of myth. Belief in the administrator as a supernatural deity of some kind, and just so stories.
Jackpot. Maybe I'd finally get a complete picture of the history of Heaven's River. So, what do you think, the administrator? The captain's voice cut through everything.
All right, you lazy sots, this tub won't steer itself. Are you going to leave that mess on the deck forever? Do I pay you to sun yourselves? Hop to it.
Aside, lunch 10 minutes was over. The next day's topic was life after death. Oryk and Frieda, no surprise, had opinions that tended toward the mystical. Teresa, bless her heart, didn't mock or condescend, but she did ask questions that they found very hard to handle. During a lull while Oryk and Frieda were regrouping, she turned to me.
You've been quiet, Enoki. Don't have an opinion.
I chuckled. That'll be the day. I guess the real problem is defining what you mean by life after death.
I would have thought it was self-explanatory.
The supernatural version, sure. Also unprovable, at least so far. But what about a more, science-oriented version? I launched into a highly abbreviated explanation of replication. When I was done, Oryk and Frieda looked equal parts confused and appalled.
That's not the same,
Frieda exclaimed.
That's just a copy of you.
But if original you isn't around anymore, it sure beats the alternative, I replied with a grin. Teresa laughed.
And to anyone else, it might make no difference. If a copy of me loved to chase my grandchildren around and remembered everyone's birthdays, how would you tell it wasn't original me?
But it wouldn't be.
There's a postulate in information theory that information can't be destroyed, I said slowly. I was sticking my neck out. I knew it. I watched myself doing it and couldn't stop. This might be well beyond what Quinlan's had managed to retain. And in philosophy, there's something called a closest continuer, which, according to some thought, actually would be you, even if there was a gap. Teresa gave me a quizzical look.
I can get the definition of closest continua from context, but I'd love to hear more about this bit about information theory.
There were groans from the others. It appeared advanced physics was not a popular subject. I was in my VR library studying some of the blueprints of Heaven's River produced from scans by the Skippies and Gamers when I received an alert from my Manny's AMI. Sentry Roamer reports disturbance. That meant someone or something was disturbing my trunk. I quickly entered my Manny and climbed quietly to my feet. It was full night and Ted was on watch. The ersatz starlight was enough to illuminate the shore if we got too close, but it generally wasn't a problem, as the current and wind tended to keep the boat in the middle of the river. Ted would wake us up if some emergency navigation became necessary. Meanwhile, we had a small lantern on bow and stern, just enough to mark our position for any other boats, but not enough to affect night-adapted eyes. Of course, that didn't matter for a Manny equipped with real night vision. Someone had peeled back part of the tarp and was bent over the trunks. Someone with a, shall we say, extra-wide silhouette? I walked quietly up behind Snidely and whispered, "It's locked, asshole." He jerked up and turned to face me.
"Very well locked, it would seem. Better than mine, which appears to be the same quality."
Huh. He just out and out admitted he was trying to break into my trunk. Probably a punchline of some kind was coming. "Is there a point, Snidely, other than that you're a thief?" He smirked back at me.
"Well, Enoki, I happened to be watching when we pulled into Beetlejuice. It was very impressive how you managed to get them to not inspect your trunk."
I frowned. How so? They didn't inspect either trunk.
"But I ordered them not to inspect mine. You tricked them into thinking I had two trunks."
"I didn't do anything except pull off the tarp, Snidely." "They made an assumption. Should I have begged them to please open my trunk? I notice you didn't volunteer."
"Very glib, Enoki. Tell you what, since it's all so innocent, why don't you open your trunk for me?"
"You first."
"My trunk," he said haughtily, "is not under suspicion.
Neither is mine, dumbass. Meanwhile, I found you trying to break into my property, which gives me the right to defend it. So here's the thing." I stepped up until my beak was right up against his. "If I catch you trying that or anything similar again, I will rip off your head and shit down your neck. We clear?" Snidely stepped back, clearly not prepared for the level of implied violence I was projecting.
"I will tell the captain you threatened me.
I will tell the captain you are a thief. I wonder which one of us will be tossed off the boat." He glared for a few more seconds, then turned and stalked off. But I knew this wasn't over. Not by a long shot. 17. Trolling for Treasure. Bill, August 2334, Vert, Pits of Payback. The troll lay at my feet, sliced in two, the halves neatly cauterized. I cleaned my sword carefully and resheathed it. I'd gotten the flame blade and some enchanted armor in exchange for the staff of fireballs and most of my portion of Garg's hoard. It had been a fair trade in that both myself and Saruman the Wise claimed we'd been fleeced. Still, neither of us backed out of the deal. Our dungeon party was currently creeping along a dark hallway in the Pits of Payback. When asked about the name, the current DM would only smile mysteriously and say that all would be made clear at the conclusion of the campaign, which probably meant a bad pun or something was in our future. Kevin was back, as his original character, having left behind just enough identifiable pieces to allow a resurrection. Gandalf had used one of his scrolls after taking all of Kevin's remaining worldly goods in payment. Kevin seemed to have finally gotten over the loss of his staff, thankfully. I hadn't been subjected to any more glares, at least. Tim, who hadn't left anything but floating ash, was back as a first-level thief. He was staying in the center of the group until he leveled up enough to not be killed by an inadvertent sneeze. Vern, Pete, and I provided the muscle and sharp implements. So far, we'd been able to handle the encounters, but the increasing difficulty sent a pretty clear message that we were getting close to the payoff. Gandalf strode along just behind me, acting like King of the Mountain. I hoped his talents matched up to his attitude. He was remarkably close-mouthed about his actual abilities and assets. "That was a troll," Tim said, unnecessarily. We turned to look at him. "And?" Vern said. "Pretty hefty monster for this level of dungeon," Tim answered. "If not for Bill's flame blade, I'm not sure we'd have been able to take it down. Not without losing another player or two, anyway." I looked back in the direction of the troll carcass. Tim was right. I'd gotten too used to being able to cleave just about anything with one swipe, but trolls were, generally speaking, more than a handful.
"Are you suggesting we're being set up?" Gandalf asked. "Anyone made any enemies lately?"
I glanced at Kevin, who gazed back at me innocently. That was a long shot anyway. If Kevin was that sensitive about losing treasure, he'd never make it as a gamer. Everyone else was looking around at everything and nothing as they considered their own recent pasts.
"There's a secret door here."
We all turned to Tim's comment. He was poking at a random section of wall.
"You sure?"
"It's about the only thing I'm good for," Tim replied. "Why do you think I picked this character class?"
"Fair enough," I said. "Let's see if we can crack this."
We all started poking, twisting, pushing, lifting and pulling every protuberance in the area. A few seconds later, a door opened with the typical stone grinding sound effect, revealing a pitch black tunnel.
"That looks dark," Tim said, "and cramped."
He pulled a copper piece out of a pocket and tossed it into the blackness. There was a dull thump, followed by a metallic tinkle.
Yeah, something's in there. Anyone got a light spell?
Or a flashlight?" We needn't have bothered. Whether we woke it up with the coin toss or it simply decided it had lost the element of surprise, the demon hound charged out of the tunnel straight at Vern. He, a battle-hardened, fearless half-dwarf warlord, went rigid with fear. Seriously, the hound knocked him over like hitting an inflatable Bozo the Clown. Apparently, the hound had been expecting more resistance than Bozo had been able to deliver. It continued on in its trajectory, speed unabated, and fetched up against the far wall with a loud thump. The hound made an oddly human oof noise and slid down the wall to land in a heap. Pete, who hadn't gone rigid, took the opportunity to impale the beast before it could get up. As the light went out of the hound's eyes, Pete smiled and said, "About time I got a good kilt." The second demon hound hit him at neck height, taking his head clean off.
"Shit,"
his head said as it bounced along the floor. I finally unfroze, pulled my sword, and parted the hound cleanly.
"Well, that's suboptimal,"
Gandalf said. He grabbed Pete's head by the helmet crest and lifted it until they were face to face.
"No resurrections, buddy. Even if you could afford it, I used my last scroll for Kevin."
Pete's head said,
"Yeah, okay, I was getting tired of this character anyway."
The conversation was interrupted by a heavy bass growl ahead of us in the hallway.
"What the blinkin' blue blazes was that?"
Kevin whispered. Tim replied,
"Dunno, but it had a certain quality of bigness to it."
"And hungriness," I added. Tim peered into the tunnel.
"I think we're being herded, but it's this or go straight back. I kind of wish you still had that staff, Bill."
I shook my head in reply.
"Firing it off in that cramped space would as likely as not cook all of us with the blowback. Gandalf, you got anything for close-order fighting?"
"Not like what you mean, Bill. I think your flame blade is our best hope."
"Wonderful."
This meant I would be going first, holding my magic sword out in front of me in hopes of killing an attacker before it could get to us, which would do diddly squat against a magical attack. My future began to truncate in front of me. I shrugged and edged carefully into the tunnel.
"Someone want to shed some light on this?"
Gandalf muttered something and a light shone over my shoulder, illuminating the tunnel ahead. The tunnel wasn't high enough for us to stand straight, so we were forced to move forward, bent at the waist. If I'd been bio and doing this in real, I would have had back spasms within a minute or two, but in the spirit of classic D&D, The game engine allowed us to overlook some of the more realistic aspects of adventuring. The tunnel eventually terminated in a blank wall. We all turned to Tim, who shrugged. I don't see anything. I'm getting tired of this campaign, Vern muttered. We've been battling high-level beasts since almost the entrance, lost over half our group, and we have sweet diddly to show for it.
Hopefully the final payday is worth it, Gandalf checked through his satchel. I have a spell of true seeing in here somewhere.
Ah. He pulled out a small notebook and paged through it, a few seconds of nodding and muttering, and he looked up.
Let's try this.
Gandalf made some gestures and spoke in an arcane tongue. He then squinted and peered intently around, checking the blank wall and the tunnel wall around it.
Nothing. What the hell?
We all stared at the blank wall. Red herrings were one thing, but dead ends generally needed to have a point. I'm really starting to hate this DM, Tim said, and turned around to head back up the tunnel. He took three steps, then said, Really, really, really hate. We looked past him at the blank wall where a tunnel used to be. We were now in a section of tunnel about 20 feet long, blocked at both ends. I frowned. Gandalf, is your true-seeing spell still active?
Yes, for another minute or so.
See anything in this tunnel we should know about?
Nope.
What blocks or counters are true-seeing?
Higher-level magic, of course, but I'd sense that.
Tim, you see anything significant? No, and a true-seeing would pick it... Hold on. Tim put his hand near a section of wall. There's a draft here. We moved over to it and each took a turn feeling for the slight airflow.
On the list of things that defeat a true seeing, Gandalf opined, we can add low-tech tricks like building a wall without mortar.
He pushed on the section of wall and it gave a little. We all put our backs into it, and after a few seconds of resistance, the wall collapsed outward. The good news is that it crushed several of the zombies who were waiting on the other side. The bad news is that it alerted all of their still uncrushed brethren. We were at one end of a large subterranean hall with a ceiling so high it was lost in the gloom. Torches lined the walls, giving enough light to illuminate dozens of zombies milling around the chamber, and a large, nondescript statue at least 20 feet tall standing at the center. Oh, shit, Tim exclaimed and backpedaled frantically.
Brains,
said the zombies and advanced on us.
Now hold on, Vern exclaimed. That's entirely the wrong kind of...
Shut up, Vern,
Gandalf growled. Kill now, carp later.
I raised my sword and started swinging, perhaps a little too enthusiastically as Vern yelled, Hey, watch it! And danced out of the way. Without Pete, we were down to two fighter characters. Even with magical accessories, Vern and I wouldn't be able to hold off a bunch of undead.
If you've got anything in that bag of tricks, Gandalf, now would be the time, I yelled. Give me a sec,
he yelled back. I could hear muttered curses, then,
Aha!
There was a pup and a zombie that was trying to eat Vern's axe turned into a cloud of smelly gas. My eyebrows went up, but I didn't have time to think about it. Zombies weren't particularly powerful opponents, but they made up for it with sheer numbers and a total lack of fear, and they were very hard to kill. You generally had to reduce them to sushi before they'd stop coming at you, and I had at least a dozen of the critters about to step into range. I cocked my sword arm and pop, pop, pop.
Woohoo!
Gandalf yelled. The sudden disappearance of several zombies gave me time for a quick glance over my shoulder. Gandalf was gesturing with a wand. Each time he pointed it, there was another pop.
Damn, that's handy,
Vern said and chopped another couple of zombies.
Bibbidi boppity boo,
Gandalf replied, dancing around and waving his wand.
Bibbidi-boppity-bibbidi-boppity-pibbidi-bobbidi-boo.
With each downbeat, another zombie went up in smoke. The odor was verging on overpowering, and the game engine wouldn't let me turn down my olfactory sense. We were down to the last dregs of the zombies, and I was beginning to think we might survive this when a huge hand reached out of nowhere and wrapped around me. I found myself hoisted into the air, unable to draw a breath. The last few zombies disappeared with popping sounds, and Gandalf stopped the song and dance routine. Strangely, I don't think anyone had noticed my predicament until that moment, judging from the shocked expressions.
"Little help?"
I managed to squeak. "Hello, Wabbit," a voice said from behind us. Vernon Gandalf turned. I couldn't move, but the huge hand helpfully rotated me to face the voice to find Kevin grinning at me, holding a scroll. "Golem," he explained, waving the scroll. The helpful hand turned me around again, and I was finally able to see what I'd previously assumed was a statue. A 20-foot-tall, clay-colored humanoid shape stared back at me impassively, with a face surprisingly reminiscent of Odo from DS9. It loosened its grip slightly so that I could more easily breathe and talk. Kevin put the scroll into a pocket and I reflexively struggled. No joy, of course. He didn't have to hold the scroll to control the golem, just possess it. And golems, besides being almost indestructible, were hella strong. Kevin walked a little ways to the side to put some distance between himself and the rest of the group, still smirking triumphantly but not saying anything. It looked like he was going to wait for us to ask the first question. "What's going on, Kevin?" Vern asked obligingly. Kevin gestured at me. "Bill here. First time in a campaign he goes from dragon fodder to a level above me by basically tripping over himself. Does practically nothing and comes out golden. Plus, I took your staff of fireballs. I'm sure that figures into it." Kevin glared at me. "You needed to be taken down a peg, bud." He directed a nasty grin my way. "So I set up this campaign and made sure you were invited."
"You played and DM'd?" Gandalf exclaimed.
"No, I've got a friend running the show. I'm just what you might call a backstabber," Vern finished for him. "Whatever. None of you have anything that can take out a golem. Enjoy your deaths, courtesy of Bill. And speaking of Bill..." Kevin raised a hand and made a squeezing motion. I waited for the end, hoping the sensory feedback filter was set way high. But nothing happened. Kevin got a perplexed look on his face and repeated the motion. Still nothing. Kevin reached into his pocket, and the concerned expression changed to panic. "Looking for this?" We all turned to Tim's voice. He was leaning up against the wall, casually flipping a scroll in his hand. "Oh yeah, that's right. Thief." "You truly are an asshole, Kevin," Tim said and opened his other hand. The golem dropped me, then reached out, grabbed Kevin around the head, and squeezed. There was a pop sound, not the least bit like a zombie exploding, and squishy juice squirted from the top of the golem's fist. Vern bent over and retched.
"Oh, God!" Gandalf exclaimed. "Did you have to do that?"
Tim grimaced in sympathy. "Okay, maybe not my best move. However," he held up the golem scroll, "I appear to be in possession of one kick-ass piece of magic. I feel some leveling up in my future. Let's see what else we can find." We grinned at each other. Another successful campaign. I'd invited myself over to Gandalf's VR again, and he was eyeing me suspiciously. Maybe he was expecting another lecture on the gamer's involvement in the expedition, but that wasn't what I was worried about this time. "So, about Kevin. That's not Bob-like behavior. How far has he drifted, anyway?"
Gandalf shrugged. "He's actually one of my descendants. I could ask him, but off the cuff I'd say he's about 24th generation, so it shouldn't be a surprise that he's drifted a lot."
"Bit of an asshole. A vindictive one at that."
"Yeah. Listen, Bill. I get why the whole drift thing bothers the senior Bobs, but you need to appreciate that from our point of view, it's more upside than otherwise."
"Well, that was interesting." I raised my eyebrows and made a rolling motion with a hand for him to continue.
"When we first started the gamers group, most of us were still mostly Bob-like, and frankly, it was a little boring. Everyone wanted to be a magic user. The dungeons tended to all feature intellectual puzzles. Everything was carefully balanced, all very civilized. Now..." Gandalf made a helpless gesture. "Nowadays, you can't always depend on your fellow players. Sometimes crazy shit happens. like today, and sometimes things go wildly out of control. Campaigns are way more fun these days. Also, we are now getting non-Bob replicants joining up from some of the post-life replicant arcologies. What? Seriously? Who? No one today. This was all Bob's, but a couple of guys from your last time out were ex-human. Interesting that you didn't notice. Huh. Well, he had a point. So, Kevin is going to suffer a loss of reputation, but not so much for the attempted backstabbing as for failing at it. We'll still let him join campaigns. We just won't let him stand behind us, if you know what I mean. I chuckled and shook my head. You're right. It's too easy to get myopic and see everything from the point of view of my own priorities. And that's going to become an increasingly dangerous habit. I think I have to make an effort to start seeing everyone as individuals. I stood. Thanks, Gandalf, for the game and for the lesson. He was still smiling when I popped out. 18. Trouble with Snidely. Bob, August 2334, Nirvana River System. It was kind of a good news, better news thing. The good news was that Snidely was now avoiding me. The better news was that everyone else had noticed and was actively hanging around me. I wondered why I hadn't thought of this tactic when I was alive. We were on our lunch break and were once again sitting around the fish bowl, by which I mean bowl of fish. Yum! We'd gotten on to the concept of morality, and Frida had just asked Teresa how she could have any sense of morality without a deity to define what was or was not moral. And as usual, I was having to grit my teeth to avoid doing a facepalm, which wasn't a Quinlan expression. They didn't seem to have a direct equivalent either, or I'd have used it by now.
What deities give you aren't rules of morality, Teresa responded. They're just rules. Do this and you'll be rewarded. Do that and you'll be punished. That's how we teach our pets not to relieve themselves in the house. One would hope that true morality involved more than learning not to poop on the rug by being rapped on the nose.
I remembered that small animal Garfield had seen wearing the cone of shame. It seemed pet behavior was another universal.
In fact, Teresa continued, I believe that it is only possible to acquire true morality without input from a deity. It is only when you do something because you believe it is the right thing to do, instead of because of any moral deserts, that you are acting morally. Likewise, it is only when you refuse to do something because of the golden rule rather than because of a threat of punishment that you are behaving in a moral manner.
Ah, I piped up. The golden rule, treat others as you'd like to be treated. Teresa gave me a perplexed look.
No, that's the silver rule.
What? Had I missed something?
There are three rules of behavior,
Teresa replied, now in lecture mode.
The iron rule, treat others less powerful than you however you like. The silver rule, treat others as you'd like to be treated. The golden rule, treat others as they'd like to be treated.
Huh. I had not heard that. Teresa frowned at me.
Seems like an odd gap. How far away is your home? Maybe they need a missionary visit.
From an atheist?
Frida said archly. Wait, I gestured at Frida with an upheld hand, then to Teresa. How is that better?
If I treat you how I want to be treated, I'm not taking into account your desires.
Teresa made an imploring gesture.
If you are a unitist and can't eat land meat, but land meat is my favorite, the silver rule says I'm behaving morally by offering you a steak if you're hungry. But of course you won't eat it, and in fact, maybe offended.
So the silver rule is still to a large extent about me and my desires. However, with the golden rule, I am obligated to take into account your beliefs and preferences when deciding how best to behave toward you. Does this not produce a better result?
Huh, I said. Again, not sounding very smart, Bob. I'll have to think about that, Teresa smiled.
That's the best sentence any teacher could hear. But,
Frida interjected,
you could believe literally anything, and there's no way to decide which is right.
Shall we just sail right past port, then?
Captain Lisa's voice washed over us. Damn, she had presence. I wondered if captains practiced that kind of yelling.
Maybe we should just sail into the rocks, then. Perhaps when you have a few seconds, you could steer this mother-bedamned tub.
Once again, lunch 10 minutes was over. We pulled into Orchard Hill without incident. As soon as the gangplank was in place, Snidely stalked down it and away, cutting in front of the captain. He wasn't carrying his trunk, so unfortunately he'd probably be back, and Captain Lisa would likely have a few things to say to him. The captain and the dockmaster got into the usual spitting and shouting match, which, as usual, terminated with work for us. We began hauling boxes off the hurricane and stacking them on a low-slung cart specifically designed for this. It was mindless work and allowed me to think. I'd been on the move for a week and had traversed a segment. Assuming that was a reasonable speed, I'd be a month and a half getting to Garrick's spine. Maybe a little more, since I'd also have to move from the Nirvana back to the Arcadia. Maybe I could get on a boat that crossed as part of their regular route. I was interrupted in my ruminations by something undefinable. There's a particular sound, or maybe a change to the normal background, that happens when cops show up. It's subtle, but it's enough to make you stop and look. Coming down the dock was Snidely, talking animatedly to one of four cops. I doubted that he was trying to get them to check the hurricane's boating license, assuming they had such things. Snidely marched straight up to me and, with triumph in his voice, said, "This one." The cop, presumably the ranking officer, examined me, head slightly cocked.
"Doesn't match the description,"
he sighed.
"Nevertheless, we're here."
He motioned me to precede him up the gangplank.
"What's going on?"
Captain Lisa demanded. She placed herself in front of the spokescop, blocking his path. He gestured to Snidely.
"This gentleman has accused this man of being the fugitive who is currently being sought through several segments."
"Based on the fact that he tried to break into my trunk and I threatened him," I said.
"And why would he be trying to break into your trunk?"
"You've known him for 5 minutes. Tell me honestly if that doesn't seem in character." The cop said nothing, but his face took on the stony cast that meant someone was trying to suppress a facial expression. After a moment, he sighed.
"Nevertheless, we're here, and Mr. Whiplash is from a family."
He turned to the captain.
"You can refuse to let me on board, but the dockmaster can also refuse to continue to load and unload. Your choice."
Captain Lisa gave Snidely a murderous glare before replying to the sergeant.
"You have permission. He does not."
She turned to Ted.
"Bring Mr. Whiplash's trunk down."
Snidely smiled at her.
"Big deal. I'll have another ride by the end of the day."
"But it won't be with us," the captain replied. "And the shipping community is small and tight-knit. Don't be too sure of your options."
She pulled her vest pocket open and rummaged for a moment, producing 2 coins.
"Here's the balance of your fare."
She threw the coins to the ground at Snidely's feet. I'll give Snidely credit. He ignored the coins. He also dealt her a glare that made her previous salvo look like a love fest. If people had started shooting lightning bolts from their eyes, it wouldn't have surprised me. The coins rolled a short distance, and a couple of spectators pounced on them. The sergeant gave Captain Lisa a look that might have been sympathy, then turned back to me and gestured again to the plank. We passed Ted on his way back, carrying Snidely's trunk. A brief glance assured me that he hadn't gotten the wrong one. The tarp had been stripped back and left off. I pulled my trunk from the pile, placed it flat, and unlocked it. The cop reached forward and opened the lid to reveal... stuff. A folded vest, some small tools, several books, a miniature ceramic figure, and a diary and writing implements. He pushed a few items around, frowned, then frowned at me.
"This is just common goods. Why did you not just show him this?"
"Would you have if that pompous ass demanded it of you?" The cop snorted.
"No, not likely. I think Mr. Whiplash is going to have some explaining to do. Wasting the constabulary's time is not without consequence. My apologies for the trouble."
I smiled and nodded, and the cops marched back to the dock. I imagined a sharp and hopefully not short conversation in Snidely's future. I glanced at the shipping container that currently held Bender's Matrix instead of these random items. I'd have to swap things back tonight, as that particular container was destined for the next stop.
"What a putz," Ted said.
I grinned and pushed the fishbowl toward him. "Yeah, but did you see the look on his face as they marched him up the dock? I think he's going to have an interesting afternoon." Teresa accepted a fillet from Belinda and chewed thoughtfully on it for a few seconds.
"Sadly, he will probably have many children."
We all chuckled. Harvey, our new deckhand, said,
"It sounds like I missed an interesting time. I've had to deal with obnoxious passengers before. Never fun."
Teresa turned to me.
"So, Enoki, tell me more about utilitarianism."
There were groans from the others. It turned out that dislike for moral philosophy transcended species. Frida was holding the night watch again. That helped, as I'd spent time last night working out her routine. Now I had to switch back the contents of my trunk and the shipping container, but, you know, night vision. I had both containers open and had moved the miscellaneous items back into the shipping box. I held up Bender's Matrix and was about to place it carefully in the organics that formed my trunk's padding, when a voice behind me said,
"That's very pretty. What is it?"
I whirled, almost fumbling the Matrix, to find Teresa smiling at me. I said.
"It is about the size of a funerary box, and since you took steps to hide it, I have to assume some level of guilt, if that's the right word."
Well, this was just peachy beyond belief.